All right. Let her rip.
Okay, well, I'm very pleased to announce our final speaker. That's Stephen Downs from the National Research Council in Canada, and he'll be talking about managing digital rights using JSON.
Okay, well, it's a pleasure for me to be here and to speak to the audience today. I'm just setting up the audio and video recording here. And I hope that records okay. Hi, world. Hi to the four people in the audience here. And I'll just move the microphone here so we got a better audio. Got a little indistinct thump on the audio. The title of this talk is Managing Digital Rights Using JSON. First of all, who I am, because probably nobody has heard of me. That's evident from the size of the crowd. I'm a senior researcher for the National Research Council.
To do with the talk after lunch.
Yeah, the talk after lunch. Work for the National Research Council Institute for Information Technology, Learning and Collaborative Technologies Group. I'm a specialist in online learning and new media and resource metadata. My website is downs.ca. I'm working on three major projects at the moment, something called Synergique 3, which is the focus of today's discussion, as well as a personal learning environments project and an OL daily newsletter. It's kind of interesting, with four people in the audience, we had two people who couldn't see because of the person in front. You can feel free to move chairs, like, if it'll give you a better view. It's just funny that there's like one other person in the audience and you're leaning around their head to see. I'm located in Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada. That's on the east coast of Canada, about 20 kilometers from the Atlantic Ocean. It's located on the University of Moncton campus. It's a French-speaking campus. Our group was created in 2007 because of market interest and market pressures. We have expertise in a variety of areas related to e-learning and learning technology, including cognitive psychology, cognitive modeling philosophy, that's me, social networks, learning communities, broadband, and the rest. We have major broad research and development areas, specifically technologies to reduce development time for the creation of learning resources, and that's the focus of the Synergique project that I'm talking about today, and technologies and resources to enhance learning outcomes, and that largely is the focus of the Personal Learning Environments project. Why learning and collaborative technology? Well, when you look at the demographics of Canada and of New Brunswick, it becomes pretty obvious. A large proportion of our population is rural. We can't count on them always being able to come into the cities in order to do their advanced learning, their professional development. Even in New Brunswick, we see a considerable number of people working at a distance. New Brunswick has one major French language university, which is in Moncton, but we have French language people across the province and indeed around the world. Synergique, which is the major project that we're working on, is a software framework for the development of learning tech or learning resources collaboratively through a group of developers. It's a collaborative effort between ourselves, learning management system called Desire to Learn, and the University of Moncton. We've got a variety of research and development areas, including what we call distributed digital rights management. The scope of the research is distributed digital rights management, metadata extraction, learning design and instructional design accelerators, and workflow or product accelerators. There are things that are out of scope, for example, a distributed learning object repository network, which is a baby of mine, which doesn't really exist yet, and work opportunity billboards and other such things. I am the chair of the research of the Synergique project, and as you can see, we've got a number of people from all three partners working on the research and development work group. distributed digital rights management is the focus of this talk and this presentation. The purpose of distributed digital rights management is to facilitate rights management. And this is not just about access control, copy protection and that, but rather the focus on easier handling of usage rights. And what we are attempting to do is streamline the whole process of accessing materials in a rights compliant way. And I will point out, just as an aside, this is not a rights enforcement scheme. This is not like copy protection or anything like that. It's a mechanism for the expression of digital rights. And then it's up to the consumer or the technology that does the consuming how to respect the rights that have been expressed. DDRM, as I say, is a mechanism for managing copyrights. The purpose here is to provide a low-cost and distributed mechanism rather than relying on centralized rights servers, which, as you know, can crash and disappear on you. It's intended to be a novel solution with clear advantages over existing mechanisms, and I'll talk about that, and additionally to take advantage of existing browser capacities rather than trying to develop from the ground up new technology. So, on to the details. JSON, as you probably all know, a lot of this you probably all know, otherwise you wouldn't be in the room, right? Stands for JavaScript Object Notation. JavaScript, as you know, is an object-oriented programming language, kind of object-oriented. It's located on web pages, processed in a browser, and gives you direct access to the document object model in the web page. JSON is the notation that is used specifically to store data in JavaScript. It accesses the DOM directly, and the JSON files themselves may be accessed directly from the web page that you're looking at, or they may be imported from a remote location. This will turn out to be significant. JSON syntax is really simple. It's so simple I can't believe I'm using two slides to express it. You have a basic syntax which simply connects labels to data, for example, the label name and the data Stephen. It's worth noting that this is not processed or evaluated. Rather, it is the subject of processing or evaluation. The data and the label are available immediately without any intermediary to the JavaScript code. The complete set of syntax allows for sets and lists to be created using brackets and quotation marks. And just for the people who are watching on video, I just want you to know, we've had a rush, and the size of the audience has almost doubled. So welcome to the new people. I'm just partway through the talk. You haven't missed anything good. Well, you have, but you'll have to watch it on the recording. I'm just kidding. Here's an example of JSON. It's just a really simple partial example. It just gives you the idea of what's going on in a JSON expression, where you have the labels which are to the left, such as menu, and then the value. The value can be a set of other labels and values. So for example, the value of the label menu is a set consisting of a label ID and a value file, a label value, a value file, a label pop-up, and a value, again, a more complex set and lists of labels and values. So the idea here of JSON is that you can create really a nice structured hierarchy of data consisting of labels and values. The brackets and the quotation marks delimit the values. They serve no processing function, and they create a nice nested hierarchical structure. Sorry about the spelling mistake there. It's not parsed or interpreted in any way. It's part of the web page, included in the DOM. Very important. Wouldn't be novel if you have to go do a whole bunch of parsing. So that's the technical side of things, the JSON, right? Everybody knows JSON. Now, on the other side of this equation, we have rights expressions. A rights expression is a statement of permissions and duties associated with the use of a resource. And there's no predetermined value to those permissions and duties, so it may be fully restrictive, all rights reserved, or it may be fully permissive, no rights reserved, and everything in between. Rights expressions are not required. Under copyright law, rights assigned to objects automatically on the creation of the object to the author of the object, nor are rights expressions fully stipulative. That is to say, they do not express completely the rights associated with an object. There may be additional rights or additional conditions in law, such as fair use provisions, expiration, and other statutory limitations. These not really relevant to this discussion, but it's worth noting that these are the cases. Instances of rights expressions are two major instances. It's not an exclusive list. First instance of a right expression is a license, which is a document assigning a permission to use something. Sorry, they put me in a smoking room last night after losing my reservation, so my voice is a little... And a rights expression may also be a statement of ownership. And of course, you can think of a subcase there, which is an assignment of ownership from one owner to a new owner, etc. Generally, when we look at rights expressions, there are four major elements of rights expressions. First of all, the rights holder, and of course, there may be an entire structure or a simple reference delineating a rights holder. The resource in question may be specified by a resource identifier, may be specified implicitly if the license is contained in the resource, etc. And then a set of one or more actions and conditions where the action is a specific use to be put, like copying, viewing, selling, reselling, modifying, whatever. And then conditions, which are requirements, duties, or limitations on that action. So, for example, you can copy it, but only if you pay a dollar. And we have another person now that actually doubles our attendance. Oh, she may not be permanent. Hi and welcome. I'm sort of tempted to pan the aisle, but you're going to leave, aren't you? You just came for some money. No? Oh, you're going to stay. Shame the audience into staying. Oh, that's sad. I'm just teasing. Common examples of rights expression language: open digital rights language, which is basically, it's kind of silly to say open source, but it's a free digital rights expression language, and it's not limited by copyrights or anything like that. And I don't know why.
Is it XML?
Yes, ODRL is an XML language. It's created by a guy called Renato Iannella. You can find it at odrl.org online. Ignore that sentence that says statement of ownership. That's not part of this slide, even though it really looks like it is. Another one is called MPEG-REL, formerly known as XRML, XML, Rights Management Language. It was created by Content Garden. Basically, they created XRML, patented it like crazy, and I'll talk a bit about that in a bit, and then started shopping it to the standards groups, for example, to ISO, where it stalled, to MPEG, where it was passed as MPEG Rights Expression Language, and to others. Another one that doesn't get talked about a lot but really should be included in this set is Creative Commons, which is probably of the three the most widely used, millions of instances around the world. And the XML expression of Creative Commons is in something called CCREL, which is a simple RDF version of the standard Creative Commons licenses. Creative Commons is a bit different from the other two in that it's not nearly as open-ended. Both ODRL and MPEG-REL allow for very complex and precise descriptions of actions and conditions and ownerships and all of that. Creative Commons is limited to a simple set of partial limitations on use, such as sharing alike, that is passing the resource on to additional users under the same condition that you got it, attribution, so making it clear the source or the author of the resource that you're using, non-commercial, restricting the use to non-commercial purposes, etc. Yes, absolutely. Please, it would be ridiculous with this audience to not allow interruptions, so please go ahead.
So there are no open source BI frameworks implemented. Do they use any of these writing languages, or what do they use, or where are these ODR used, or who's using it?
Okay, I'm not sure of what specific open source rights expression language frameworks are using, but I would bet you that they're using ODRL. If they're not using ODRL, then they're using something that would be specific and particular to that particular framework. But I mean, we'd have to go look up each of them. I have internet access, we can actually do that if we need to. But they will use some expression language of some sort. If they're not using ODR, there's no way in the world they'll be using MPEG REL. They won't be using it simply because of ContentGuard's assertion of its patent. So nobody coding an open source rights expression interpreter system is going to be using MPEG REL. Is that an answer?
Yes, because I was referring to the one by Sun. Sun has an open source DRM framework. Okay. I haven't looked into it, so I don't know which one.
I haven't looked into it, so I don't know either. So, but let's note that down, and we'll come back to that because we can look that up, right? So, it's a new computer, so I don't know where anything is. I just want a notepad. Is there a notepad? No notepad. Oh, for goodness sakes. There are unsaved changes to the document. Okay, so Sun, I'm sorry.
Yes, Sun has an open source DRM.
Open source DRM framework. All right, we'll look that up after and we'll see what they're using. But I'll bet you if they're using anything. Does anyone know? No? Good. I'm not the only one who doesn't know. Good. All right, moving on. So, there is prior art on this stuff in the patent literature, and just as the caveat, this prior art was researched at the time of submission of this paper and not the time of delivery of this paper, which is now, so it's a few months old, but it's not bad. It's a fairly representative, even if there has been some new stuff, it's still fairly representative of the field. So we've got some patents out there. Lucent has an old patent on a system, it's kind of hard to believe, a system that checks for content rights. IBM has an old patent floating around on the use of the Java virtual machine to govern access to resources. But really, the patent landscape in this field belongs to ContentGuard. ContentGuard, if you're not familiar with it, is kind of like a holding company almost. It's owned in part by Microsoft, in part by Thomson. It was owned in part by Xerox, but I believe Xerox has sold their share. And there is a third owner, I forget who at the moment. So basically, they're kind of an industry group and for the purpose of holding and licensing these rights expression language patents. And so there's three licenses that I refer to specifically in the paper. There are three patents, rather, I refer to specifically in the paper. There are others. One to license systems and access controls. One for a module to govern access to the resource. And then the biggie in this field, the rights expression in a language patent. And basically, if you talk to ContentGuard, and I have on numerous occasions over the years, including this year, you ask them, if you express rights in a language, and if you interpret that language in order to manage access to a resource, they own it. And anything you build that does that is going to be subject to licensing and royalties. Well, you can imagine we're building one of these things into our system. This is kind of a concern to us because they're actually, and this is simply an opinion, but it's an informed one, very difficult to talk to about licensing. My opinion, and I stress this, is that they're not actually interested in licensing these patents. They're interested in developing technology one day that uses these patents. They want to own this rather than license it. Just my view. But it's, again, it's my view as a result of having talked to them. Long story short, if Content Guard's patents hold, then you cannot build a system that uses any sort of language to express digital rights, which means basically you can't build a digital rights management system, period, end of story. So that's what this project is intended to get around. The argument follows. So we have Content Guard's REL patent. Now, again, it's really mushy. There is no legal action. Content Guard, they've had these for a number of years. They haven't sued anyone. ODRL has been used by the Open Mobile Alliance. It's the mobile phones for ringtones and all of that. They've used ODRL, and the OMA's use of ODRL has gone unchallenged by Content Guard. Content Guard did set up a licensing agency. One mobile phone company, I forget which one, signed up for it, but that's it. It was otherwise ignored by the mobile phone industry. The use of Creative Commons, REL, has not been challenged anywhere, although Creative Commons has been used widely. Now, the Content Guard, if you read the Content Guard patent and the language carefully, it appears to be specific to, because this is the language that is used, grammar-based languages where the rights expression is used to govern access. So you express what the right is, and you use that expression to govern the access to the resource. So it's an interpreted thing, right? You know, it's like you need to understand the language in order to access. So you look at what the language says, you parse it in some way, your software looks at the language, reads, you know, the XML document, will run it through a parser, and then apply that to the access controls. If it does that, it's covered under this patent. So, how do we go about doing this? What are the ways in which this is done? Well, first of all, there are different ways of using XML rights expressions. Now, remember, all of the rights expression languages that I've talked about so far, ODRL, XRML, and Creative Commons, are all XML rights expressions. So, either you translate and use XSLT to translate it directly, but really that's not going to give you any sort of access control, because all XSLT will do is translate it to some other format of XML or to some kind of display format. So it's not going to translate to some kind of access mechanism. So the other way to use XML is to parse it, to indirectly parse the XML using a parser, maybe like Mark Pilgrim's universal feed parser that he wrote in Python is an example of something that you could do. So you run the XML through a parser, typically a server-side parser. This parser will make some data available to you. You use that data in order to grant or not grant access to the resource in question. Now, when you're parsing XML, there's two places where you can parse it. You can either parse it on the client or you can parse it on the server. Suppose if we're technical, you could parse it somewhere on the lines in between, but that's such a fringe case, we won't talk about that. So we have the possibility server-side parsing or client-side parsing. Server-side is the web server that you have somewhere on the web, written in Python, PHP, Java, whatever. Client side is parsing that would take place in the browser itself, or if you had a separate viewer, in the viewer itself. So let's look at this in more detail. When you're parsing XML rights expressions, typically you're kind of stuck with doing it on the server or doing it in some kind of plug-in like a JVM, which is why IBM has that patent, or in Flash or some other plug-in, right? Because the browser does not offer a good environment in which to parse these XML expressions. First of all, the web pages themselves can't alter the state of the client computer. So you can't parse your data and store it as a data file anywhere. Second, and more significantly, web applications such as web browsers apply origin restrictions on network requests. The XML that is parsed can only be parsed by things that are from the same domain as the XML. You can't get XML from one place and a parser from another place or a web page from another place and put them together. It all has to come from the same domain. So these all taken together constitute what's known as the cross-domain scripting problem. It's generally a large problem. It's been a problem with SCORM because, of course, the idea here with SCORM is that you'd create learning objects that would be stored in one place and a viewer that would be located in another place. You load the objects into the viewer, but if they're from two separate places, again, you've got this cross-domain scripting problem. Same sort of thing. Anything where your resources are coming from two separate domains, you have this cross-domain scripting problem. So there's no way, really, using XML to do all of this stuff, to have your rights expression in one place, your resource in another place, and do it in the browser. You have to have some other form of parser or interpreter, which is why the Content Guard patents are so important, right? Because as soon as you use this parser or interpreter, you're subject to the patents.
But can we have a plugin, because the browser has the DOM parser, so can we have a plugin which will have the schemas for it?
The browser has the built-in DOM parser, right, which is basically the thing that reads your JavaScript object notation, right? But the thing is, if you're doing it inside the browser, using the browser's DOM parser, then everything has to come from a single domain. Your DOM parser isn't going to mix resources from separate domains.
Can you not use your server as a proxy?
Yes, and that's the common way it is done. Basically, you run the thing through a server, and then so it's almost like you're spoofing the domain, but now you're stuck using a server, right? If you don't want to use a server, if you don't want to use a proxy, if you want to do it all client-side, you can't. And as soon as you use a server, then there's a sense in what you're interpreting. And also, even if you use a server, so now you've spoofed it, so it looks like everything's coming from the same domain. Now you've got XML sitting in your browser. Great. As you say, you can parse XML in the browser. There are plenty of ways of parsing XML in the browser using JavaScript, etc. But now you're interpreting. Right now you're treating it as a language which needs to be interpreted and parsed, and you're subject to the Content Guard patents. So you can see, and just as an aside, big aside, from my perspective, this entire domain has stalled, has ground to a halt because of this. And all this is the state of affairs 6 years ago. And you look at the literature, it hasn't moved. Just hasn't, was completely stalled. So let's get rid of the cross-domain scripting problem with something called the tag hatch. Now, what the tag hatch is basically you can import JavaScript functions from a different domain into a web page. And so, and you know, from the very beginning of JavaScript has been a common thing, right? You put a script, language equals JavaScript, source equals whatever, and so you can import the JavaScript from a remote site into your browser. Now, one of the things you can do is in that JavaScript that you've imported from the third-party location, you have a document write function. You set up the document write function so that it writes some data encoded in JSON into your current web page. It doesn't have to be encoded in JSON. It could be encoded in anything. It could be divs, could be paragraphs, could be whatever. The point is, using this mechanism of server-side or a third-party JavaScript import plus document write, you can get content from a third party into the web page on the current domain in such a way that it is considered part of the current domain. It's considered part of this web page. Wonderful thing. I first used it years ago in something called the referrer system. And basically what that was the use of the tag hack in order to grab referrer data from the web page and feed it into the current web page so that I could display who sent me, I could put up a little list of referrer sites on the current web page. So you'd go to a web page, you'd see the little display, all the sites that referred you to this web page. It's kind of a neat thing. I stored the list of sites on my own server, used the tag hack to read that in, display it on the page. Really simple. It was really, really widely used by advertisers because it's a way of importing web bugs, right, from third-party vendors into the actual structure of a web page. Now, tag hack has some well-known security problems, which is one of the things that has prevented it from becoming widespread, but it's so integrated into web advertising, they'll never kill it, because it would wipe out half the internet advertising market. But it does enable data to be shared to hostile websites. So there is the possibility that, in addition to the mechanisms I'm describing in this talk, additional security mechanisms may be required for a fully functioning commercial-grade version of distributed digital rights management. So this is a caveat, a note. There may be security issues, but the mechanics of this doesn't automatically create security issues. If you trust your third party, you don't have a security issue. Okay, so how do you set this up? Think about what I want. I want a distributed system. I don't want a single centralized rights registry. I want my rights expressed in JSON that'll be imported through the tag hack to be wherever they are on the internet. And I want a system on my computer that operates in the client to be able to access resources and to read them and respect the rights. So, when I'm searching for these things, what I do is, I have to back up here a bit. What I want to do now is set these up so that I have what are called rights models. What a rights model is kind of a truncated rights expression. If you think about it, you go back to the description of rights expression languages I talked about earlier. They have the name of the resource, the owner of the resource, the conditions, and the actions. You get a rights model when you have only the list of the conditions and the actions, and they may apply to any given owner, we don't know who. They may apply to any given resource, we don't know which. An example of a rights model is $5 a piece to copy. You don't know what, you don't know who, but it's a model, right? It's a model of a kind of a transaction, right? You can even have a rights model that actually is assigned to a specific resource, and an offer is typically a kind of a rights model. An offer is not a contract, but an expression of the conditions that would obtain were you the user to actually agree to these rights. So we haven't actually established the conditions of access, they're simply proposed conditions of access. So We have the rights model. The rights model may identify the owner. It does not designate the resource. We don't know what resource it's talking about, but we can associate it with specific resources by reference to the rights model from the resource metadata. Set this up. You have a resource, say a learning object. This resource has learning object metadata, resource metadata. In that resource metadata, you have a pointer, typically a URI, to a rights model, which is an incomplete description of rights expression. And so the rights model applies to this resource. Make sense? So in our implementation, we have a rights model that is expressed in JSON. And so we have the pointer, which is in the metadata, and when we access the URI identified in the pointer, we bring in the rights model expressed in JSON into the current web page, the current resource, using the tag hack. It actually worked. So we express our rights model using JSON. Here's the workflow. When the resource metadata is being created, we offer the user the option to select from a set of previously created rights models, because you only need to create them once, right? So, you know, $5 each, $10 each, $15 each, you select from one of those. You'll apply that to the current resource, right? The $5 for the cheap little pictures, the $15 to the pictures and the descriptions, etc. So, and also we built a function that allows you to create new rights models. And it's a simple editing, form-based editing page. And it's kind of neat because we don't even need to save it to a server if we don't want, because it's all done in JavaScript and it saves rights models in JSON. But we do have a mechanism, a little simple CGI, so that you can actually save it to a server. And then, so you either select the rights model or you create a new rights model, and then that URI is input into the rights meta, the rights metadata element of the resource metadata element. Typically, the use case that we're thinking of here is IEEE learning object metadata. What is it? 14, whatever, whatever, whatever. 1411? 14. It's IEEE Learning Object Metadata, IEEE LOM. So here's how we express it in LOM. Really simple. This is a partial LOM file. This is the rights element in a LOM file. And as you can see in the description element, we just simply put in a string where the string is a URI that points to a JavaScript file. That JavaScript file is the document write function plus the JSON that we will write to the page that we're going to enter this rights model into. Here's what the rights model looks like when it's written to our web page. Of course, when you're doing it in document write, you have to add a whole bunch of extra quotation marks and backslashes and stuff so that it's syntactically correct. So this is how it looks. Again, this is a partial representation. I have a fully functional, full representation of the rights model in the actual paper itself. And as you can see, it's just a JSON data structure. No parsing, no, there's nothing fancy happening here. It's just a data structure. So the client selects a resource and finds the rights expression URI in the metadata. The client imports the rights expression metadata, which recall is that JSON expression, and then without parsing or interpreting or anything like that, simply writes the JSON into the current document. So, why is this a novel approach to rights data? Well, the JSON data can be used, and we have a demonstration and the code is included in the original paper, can be used to create a viewer, a simple little viewer that will respect the rights as expressed in the rights metadata. So if you have the right, it'll show you the thing. If you don't have the right, it won't show you the thing. And the way we set it up is if you don't have the right to do something, it'll fire you off to a third-party broker where you can obtain the right to do it. It's a novel approach because, first of all, most importantly, it's not a language. There's no semantics, there's no predicate, no if, then, anything like that. It's nothing more than a data structure. It's not used as a language, no translation, no parsing. The art, and again, if you look at the prior art that I've cited, the art in the prior art is in all cases the use and parsing of XML as a language and interpreting that in order to manage access to a resource. And then, unlike any of the prior art, none of the prior art does this, it solves the cross-domain scripting problem. Thus, it provides additional functionality over and above any of the prior art, which is what proves that it's distinct from the prior art. So that's basically the presentation. The full details, fully functional examples are in the original paper, which you have access to on the disk that you got from the conference. This work was part of the Synergy project, partially funded by the Atlantic Canada Opportunities Agency Atlantic Innovation Fund. That's for the funders. Thanks, guys. We appreciated it. And it's part of a research, as I said, development collaboration between NRC, University of Moncton, and Desire to Learn. And thank you, all eight of you, for coming to this talk. I appreciate it. And any questions or comments, I'd appreciate.
General one for someone who is not as well versed in all this technology. How is it easy to get into all this new learning environment that everyone uses and does?
How easy?
To incorporate. Now I'm thinking of.
It's going to be pretty easy because, we're talking like plain ASCII text technology here, right? That's why the URI. The pointer to the rights model is actually incorporated in existing IEEE LOM fields. So we don't need to change any of the specifications in learning object metadata. We just put it in the existing field. That's where it is. JSON is a well-known notation. It's parsed by all browsers. So, it's cross-platform. You would have to write the script to respect the JSON. There are plenty of JSON recognizing JavaScript libraries available, jQuery or MooTools, etc. Or if you don't want that, the script is in this paper, which you can have. So it's actually easier to use than some of the existing things. You probably could use it in a learning management system now, if the learning management system will allow for JavaScript. And the idea is basically you'd frame your page with this JavaScript, right, and put that page into your learning management system, and then you have a learning management system that respects rights. There's no formal requirement to set up a repository of these rights expressions because really, all a repository of these rights expressions is a set of JavaScript files. So anybody who has a web server can set up a rights model repository. There's no other requirements. So there's no centralized service. There's no registering you have to do. There's no registry you have to build or anything like that. So I would argue it's very simple to set up the system. It's one of these systems that the only thing that needs to happen is for people to use it, and if people use it, it launches off the ground fully functional. And again, the code for I mean, we've got code that creates these models. We've got code that puts these models into the JavaScript, into the LOM. We've got code which is in the paper for the viewer, which respects these models. So, I mean, this is all available.
All these rights are everything within the browser, right? All these rights which can be exercised within the browser.
That's right. Obviously, you can't have the browser doing any respecting of rights for activities that happen outside the scope of the browser. So, you know, if you print a copy, and pick up the copy and take it over to your friend, that's beyond the scope of this because there's no way the browser could influence you carrying the copy to someone. But the things that the browser can do, like save a copy, share a copy, or like through email or whatever, print a copy, etc. These are all functions that can be controlled by this.
So would it be right to say that if we have a browser which doesn't support JSON, then can we defeat the purpose of the rights model? Because it won't be able to interpret it, so then would we get access to the resource? Like, let's have a big media player inside a browser, then can we defeat the purpose of
having? Of course you can. It's not a rights enforcement system. Remember, I said that at the start, right? It's not a rights enforcement system. So, yeah, it can be defeated. You could either write some JavaScript that simply ignores the rights and accesses the resources. You know, in our fully fledged version of this that we implemented as part of a project called EduSource, we had a mechanism whereby if you did not have access to the right, then it would refer you to what we called a purchaser broker. Excuse me. And we provided open source purchaser broker code as part of the EduSource project. The purchaser broker would negotiate access using a key. It would transfer the key to the web page. And now you can see, of course, you can have JSON key transfer, right? And then the key would provide access to the resource through a proxy or a portal of some sort. So you can build things that are kind of harder to break, right? Because now you have a key that you have to somehow duplicate or access in order to get to the resource. So, you know, you can build more security into it. The main thing here, though, is the use of the rights expression to determine the action, right? And that's the part that has been blocked, first of all, by the cross-domain scripting problem, and secondly, by the content guard patents. And that's what this solves. In fact, I'll go one step further and say enforcement is evil and shouldn't be part of internet technology. If you really want to enforce this stuff, put it in the document at the very edge of the system where it belongs.
Well, I guess that was the question I was coming to. Is it possible? You talked about using a similar system to transfer keys.
Sure.
I mean, can you tie in JSON with a document? Is that a possibility? Because I guess it may not be where you see the direction.
Of course, I mean, because let's take one of these horrible locked PDF files, right? And you have to have a key to open the PDF file, say. I mean, I'm not an expert on PDF security, so let's pretend, right? So you can open the locked PDF file by declaring, by creating, you know, a PDF link. So, you know, your browser, you hit a PDF link, it'll pop open the PDF file in a PDF reader. That's very common, right? So if you have the key to open the PDF, the locked PDF file in that link, it pops open. If you have the key, it doesn't pop open if you don't have the key. Now, I don't know if that's how PDF locked PDF files work, but if that's how, because I'm not an expert in PDF and I hate PDF, so I don't. But if that's how they work, then you could do that. If you have to do something more complicated to open a locked PDF file, then your system, which can probably still be coded in JavaScript, although I don't know how, could do that. But it's going to depend on what it takes to open one of these locked files. But the principle is, you know, if there's a way of opening a locked file using JavaScript or a combination of JavaScript and some key, then this system can support it. And what's really neat is you don't need any centralized registry to do it. These keys can be anywhere. It's completely distributed. So, and this is important because it means that somebody who's a low overhead publisher can actually take part in a digital rights enabled environment, because they don't need anything fancy in order to do it. All they need is a set of rights models and maybe access to one of these purchaser vendor brokers. You know, and the way I would do it actually is I would set up purchaser brokers and vendor brokers as independent enterprises that can just provide all the turnkey functionality. But that's getting ahead of myself.
Thank you very much.
Is there
any questions? Okay, well, we thank the speaker. Thank you very much for
allowing us to talk. You're welcome. Thanks, everyone. And thank you, everybody, who's been listening on the internet. And I'm going to shut off the audio and the video now. It's always kind of weird talking to them all.